welcome Dr. Bessie House Soremeekin. Dr. House, I have known for many years, and most especially when she served as the founding executive director of the Entrepreneurial Academy of Cleveland, Ohio. It is great to be here today at KAZ Radio and TV station in Cleveland, Ohio, to launch this very exciting book. Dr. Bessie House is an internationally recognized scholar, award-winning author, professor, inventor, and entrepreneur. She is the author, editor of 8 books and numerous journal articles and book chapters. Her 7th book, Yoruba Creativity, Cultural Practices of the Modern World, was recently published by Carolina Academic Press. And we will discuss this book today. She is currently completing her 8th book, African American Entrepreneurship, Philanthropic Giving, Self-Help, and the Struggle for Economic Empowerment for Indiana University Press. Welcome, Dr. Bessie House Soremeekin.
Hello, Ms. Kennedy. It's great to be here with you today.
Absolutely, Dr. House. So let's get right into your book. Your book is outstanding, first of all. Everyone needs a copy in their library. This is a fabulous book. I am so honored to be here with you today. How did you come about writing your 7th book, Dr. House? Yoruba Creativity, Cultural Practices of the Modern World. And why did you decide to write this book?
Well, I've been a professor for many years, and one of the things that I do is to go out and do research so that I'm involved in the social production of knowledge for the society, also for my students at the university. And so I've been very interested in African cultures and traditions for quite a while. And also one of my colleagues prompted me to really expand my work on Yoruba population. And so I was very passionate about it. I have to be very passionate about the research projects that I undertake. And so I began to put together my proposal in terms of how I wanted to approach it. And then, of course, the research has taken place over the past, I guess, decade or so. I made about 6 trips to Nigeria. Mm-hmm. And in each of those trips, I was bringing some parcels of information that I could use to concretize this book. So I'm very excited that the whole project has been completed and the book is now in print.
Excellent, excellent. Your book discusses and focuses attention on the Yoruba ethnic group. Who are the Yoruba people and why are they important?
Okay, that's a very good question, Ms. Kennedy. The Yoruba population, of course, is in Nigeria, and that is the country of focus. Nigeria is a very important country in West Africa. And so the Yoruba people comprise more than 40 million people, and most of them reside in the southwestern region of Nigeria. And also some live in neighboring countries. And we also have a sizable population of Yoruba people in the United States as part of our African diaspora. So the Yoruba are one of the very important ethnic groups in Nigeria. They're one of the 3 largest ethnic groups in the country, and they have a very unique cultural and historical background. They have very, very long history of monarchical rule. They have kings and queens in their histories. They also have had some very advanced kingdoms in the pre-colonial period, long before the Europeans penetrated Africa. And so I thought it would be a very good idea to look at the rich cultural heritage of the Yoruba people and to really talk about how it manifests itself in terms of how the family is constructed, the role of the women, how it impacts on entrepreneurship and economic development. And also the chieftaincy institution that's also part of my own personal experience.
In chapter 3 of the book, you discuss the critical role of Yoruba women. How important have women's roles been in Nigeria over time?
Well, there is a saying that women hold up half the sky, and that's certainly true in Nigeria as it is in the rest of the world. So Yoruba women have always been important in Nigerian society. When you look at their roles in the pre-colonial era, on through the colonial period, and to the current period, which is post-colonial era, you find that they have been significant actors. One of the things that I would point out is women have always had important roles as wives, mothers, and nurturers of their family. So in Yoruba culture, women were encouraged to get married because marriage is a very honorable institution in the society. And also upon marriage, or after they were married, they were encouraged to go forward and multiply and have children and to nurture those children, to take care of the children, to teach them about important Yoruba cultural value systems so that these are passed on from one generation to the next. And so they were also helping their husbands and making sure that the family units were cohesive and that they were operating effectively. So the home was always a very important area. But beyond that, they were also involved in the public sphere. So they were out involved in agricultural pursuits to some extent, but also trade looms large and commercial activities. So women were encouraged to also contribute to the livelihood of their family units. And so you have a very well-rounded approach in terms of the role of women. So they have always been very much involved both in the home, outside of the home, and really helping the nation, helping the society to mature, grow, and advance. And so I talk a great deal about this in the chapter on women, marriage, mothering, and the role of the family unit. And so I certainly encourage our readers to look at that chapter.
Oh, I think it's wonderful, and particularly as you address the role of women. Would you say the role of women have changed in the Yoruba culture?
Absolutely. No culture lives in static. We're always exposed to new ideas and new value systems. And so we see that a lot of changes have taken place in Nigeria and the rest of the world. With particular emphasis on the Yoruba, we find that more Yoruba women are getting an education today. And that's something that wasn't always there in the traditional society when people had a choice over which children to send to school because of the economic impacts of educating one's children. Usually the male children were preferred. Today that's changed quite a lot. We have more women going to university, going to secondary school, post-secondary education. And so that's had a great impact. Knowledge is still power when we can be aware of what the possibilities are through education. We also have more women traveling to other parts of the world. And in the process, they are being exposed to other ideas of what other women in other cultures are doing. So you have that intercultural exchange. And also under the ambit of education, women are also able to participate in a lot of different types of careers. You have more women as lawyers. You have more women doctors. You have engineers, you have people who are working in international jobs, in the international spaces. You also have women who are writing books, who are contesting the gender inequalities that might still persist in the society. So I would say absolutely we've seen women come full scale. Now there are still some things that can be improved more or less, and obviously throughout history, we have seen that males have been the dominant actors in the society, and to some extent that might still be true, but we do see some positive impacts and some positive movements forward in that regard.
Okay, now chapter 4 focuses on the role of African kings, queens, and chiefs. Why is it important for people to know about the great heritage of Africa?
That's a very important question, and one that is really at the heart of much of my research that I've been performing for the past several decades, and that is the centrality of Africa in the world civilization process. Many people are not aware that Africa is the birthplace of humankind as we know it. When I came along some years ago, I learned absolutely nothing about Africa in the textbooks that we had in our elementary high school years. Or for that matter, when I went to through my undergraduate education, there was absolutely nothing in the textbooks about the contributions of Africa. There was no information about the contributions of African Americans. So I went out into the world without any knowledge whatsoever of the tremendous role that people of color have played in the development of global civilization and even the development of the United States of America. And so I think that something has to be done. We need more scholars. We need more writers who go out and do research and can bring back some narratives and some stories and realities that project people of color in a more positive perspective. And that is what I think my research has done. When I grew up as a little girl, I would watch television and I would see Tarzan movies and the Tarzan stories on television, and I would see a non-Indigenous African person swinging in the trees and kicking the native people. And I would always query my grandmother about how a non-Indigenous person would know more about the local landscape than the people who were born there. Why did he always come out victorious? And so when you see negative images of yourself constantly projected in society, you begin to feel bad about who you are. You don't have a high sense of self-esteem. And so I believe that we are in a great historical moment now with the in the aftermath of the globalization of Black Lives Matter movement. We now see more people interested in social equity and justice. We have more sensitization about diversity issues and inclusiveness. And the reality is that there are lots of things that have taken place, these subliminal images we have.
Absolutely.
When we see a picture of Aunt Jemima on the pancake box, why is she there? Why don't we have a woman dressed differently? Why do we have these stereotypical images portraying people of color? Uncle Remus on the rice, the rice that you're buying in the store. So there are lots of things that happen, and these subliminal images sometimes project negativity, and we do need to be more sensitized to that. And so my book is about positivity. It's about balancing the challenges and the successes amongst the Yoruba population and in Africa, more broadly speaking. So I hope that my work speaks to some of these issues and trying to look at Africa in a very multifaceted way.
I believe the book does exactly that, Dr. House. Now, you were born in the state of Alabama, which is in the southern part of the United States. In chapter 4, you did a wonderful job of recounting how you became Yoruba and the importance of that process. Can you talk a little bit about that today?
Absolutely. Part of the book really focuses a great deal on the Yorubization process. How did I, a woman who was born in a very small town in Alabama, become Yoruba? How did I become Yorubized? So very briefly, that process really started initially, I would say, with my marriage to a Yoruba man some years ago, Sir Chief Dr. Maurice Shiremakim, who is a physician who practices gynecology and obstetrics in the United States here in the African diaspora. And so as a result of that marriage, I became a Yoruba wife, and we embarked upon our life together as a Yoruba couple in a Yoruba household. And so I had to really understand the cultural context of his own culture, more specifically in terms of our relationship as a couple. And we, of course, have traveled to Nigeria many times. And in the process, of course, I became more aware of the cultural backgrounds and characteristics of the people there. And it was a great, great journey. So my Yoruba-ness has occurred over some years. And it has involved the physical part of traveling back and forth. It has involved the ability to live in a Yoruba marriage and household. It has also involved my research on the Yoruba people from a scholarly point of view and really getting to know the Yoruba. More fundamentally, the final phase of my Yorubization came when my husband and I were given 3 chieftaincy titles each in Yoruba land in 2008, and one of those chieftaincies was given to us or presented by His Royal Majesty, the Alake and paramount ruler of Egbaland, His Royal Majesty Michael Adedatum Badebo, who was the Okekinu IV. And so that was a tremendously important time for both of us, one that we will never forget.
Well, Dr. House, speaking of you and your husband obtaining 3 chieftaincies, I have no idea what that means, what that entails. Could you describe the process and kind of break it down to everyone the process of becoming a Yoruba chief, and what does that involve?
Okay, that's another very good question. First of all, I would say that the process of acquiring a chieftaincy is a fairly complicated process and very arduous one. And my husband and I were deeply humbled to be given such a high and exalted honor, because it is a very special honor in Nigerian culture and African culture more broadly speaking. Very few people are given such an honor. And the process very briefly involves a lot of steps. First of all, you have to be nominated by, in our case, another chief. And before you can receive a chieftaincy from a king, the Alake of Ekbaland, you have to have received a chieftaincy from one's own ancestral area first. So that's where it starts. So in our particular case, a particular chief had made a nomination for my husband and then subsequently myself to get chieftaincy in Kasi, because Kasi was an area affiliated with my husband's ancestral homeland area. So that is where it started initially. So the nominations went out, and there are criterion that you have to follow or criterion you have to meet in order to be considered. In Yoruba culture, for example, one has to be considered to be a good person, mm-hmm. first and foremost. And then also a person of good moral character. Moral turpitude is very important. Also a person who is seen as someone who is compassionate, someone who has a concern about his or her fellow people, fellow men or women or persons, mm-hmm. an individual who really epitomizes the positive values of Yoruba cultural, the cultural values of Yoruba society. Mm-hmm. And there are others. So these are some of the key things that one looks at in terms of the nomination process. Is this someone who could be a good role model mm-hmm. for others out there in the community? Somebody who's had a very positive impact on the society, who's concerned about the well-being of many people who are not privileged to have the opportunities to do some of the things that they would like to do. So all of these things are taken into consideration. And then the nomination goes forward. There are committees that then deliberate on this and make a determination on whether this should go forward. And in this particular case, after some time has passed, the deliberations, the vetting, it's called vetting in a competitive way, we were then informed that this would, you know, the chieftaincy would be granted. And in the case of the first chieftaincy title, that title for me was Erelu Mayagun of Kasi. Erelu Mayagun of Kasi, and my husband is Mayagun of Kasi. And so we visited Nigeria. We had a chance to interact with the chiefs there, and we were informed about the decisions on this. And of course, we also were then nominated to His Royal Majesty for another chieftaincy, and that is a higher level chieftaincy from a real living king. And so we did meet with His Royal Majesty again, the vetting process, the competitiveness, examining your backgrounds to see if you meet those criterion at that higher level of the higher chieftaincy. And then, of course, based on the deliberations and the interactions and all of that, we were informed by His Royal Majesty that indeed he would be granting my husband a chieftaincy and also a chieftaincy for me. And in that case, I became the Erelu Bada of Asiwaju of Ekbaland, and my husband was Bada Asiwaju of Ekbaland. So that was the second chieftaincy, and then the third chieftaincy was from the Church of Bakatari Christians, and that is in the area called Bakatari. And so we had three chieftaincy titles. Details were made for us to go to Nigeria to participate in the cultural ceremonies. Each of these involved cultural ceremonies, and there were things that happened. Some are confidential and cannot be divulged in terms of the Yoruba cultural things that you have to do. And then we had ceremonies that occurred in Kasi, and then after the ceremonies and you take an oath of chieftaincy, there is usually jubilation, and there are ceremony receptions that occur. Friends, well-wishers, family come in and celebrate this. And then on the second day, we went to the Ake Palace, where His Royal Majesty is in residence, and the Olori, the king and queen, the other high chiefs, members of the clergy, and other well-wishers, family mm-hmm. members, etc. It was a grand thing. Lots of people there out in the courtyard. Very, very beautiful palace. And, of course, after that, again, we went through the oath of the chieftaincy, and we had to prostrate down in front of His Royal Majesty, the king and the queen, and the chieftaincy caps. The cap that I'm wearing is the chieftaincy cap that His Royal Majesty has actually put on my head. And, of course, you see me wearing the chieftaincy beads. The chiefs are known by the beads that they wear. And so certainly, and of course, the chieftaincy cap has my title, Edelubada Asiwaju of Egbalan, on there. And of course, the third day was at the church with the Bakatari Christians. So in a nutshell, this is a very abbreviated version of the process of becoming mm-hmm. a Yoruba chief. It was a very exciting process, very humbling, and something that we will always remember.
What did it feel like to embrace and go through the cultural traditions that made you a chief?
Well, it was a very exhilarating experience, and I'm not sure I have the right words to accurately convey the emotion, the depth of emotion and humility and the awesomeness of the occasion when you're actually kneeling before a real living Yoruba king and queen. That's something that I could never have imagined happening as a small girl growing up in Lynette, Alabama, so many years ago. It was never in my wildest imagination did I ever anticipate that such a wonderful thing could happen. It was certainly one of the high points of my life, and a day that, or week that my husband and I will never, ever forget. We are very humbled, and we have made our own pledge to uplift Egbaland and the Yoruba people in the various ways that we are able to help. And so we will continue to make sure that we are doing our chiefly duties, and we are also part of the inner circle of the king, meaning that we are advisors to the king. We do talk to him regularly on cell phone when we call him up. In a few minutes, he will call us back, which makes us feel really valuable as part of his team, because he's a real living king, and certainly he has so many things on his schedule to do as he does his administrative duties over Egbaland, which is a sizable geographical area with quite a lot of people inhabiting the Egba kingdom. And so the idea that he does contact us regularly, and we're in close contact with him and traveling back and forth to Nigeria when we can, is really one of the high points of our lives.
As a scholar, Dr. House, why do you think it's important for students to be exposed to information about Africa?
Well, students definitely should be exposed to information about Africa. Again, Africa has always been poised as, quote, the dark continent. And when you think about Africa, when the Europeans went to Africa in the colonization area, in the area of imperialism and colonialism, they wrote books and they talked about Africa in very, very negative terms. They described Africans as being less than civilized, and they projected Africa in very, very negative ways. They talked about the fact that the people of color don't have large brains, which means that the intellectual quotient would be lower than other populations. And these ideas have really taken credence, and they have been part of the theories of racial superiority and racial inferiority. So if your brain is not big enough to be thinking appropriately, then you must be inferior to those who have the right size brains. And usually those people were people of lighter skin and more from European derivation. So these things loom large even today, as you have many people of color feeling that they are not as good as other populations. And so there are dangers in that when you actually have the production of self-hate and people turning against themselves and feeling low self-worth and not valuable as important actors in the society. And so young people need to be aware of the positive things about Africa. And again, I stress that we need to make sure that people know that Africa was the birthplace of humankind and that the Iron Age was upon Africa long before the Europeans actually went there. And so many other things about African civilizations, African kings and queens, these are not historical relics of the past. They're living, breathing human beings. And African chieftaincy is still a very, very respectable institution. And so we do need to arm our young people with this information, because knowledge is power, and also project to them that they can achieve whatever they set their minds to. And so that has been the positive message that I have tried to bring through my interactions with young people as a professor for several decades, and also as a researcher and professor going out and unearthing this information and making it available to people, both in making speeches and also in writing books.
In chapters 5 and 6 of the book, you focus on entrepreneurship. Now, for example, chapter 5 examines male and female businesses, and chapter 6 focuses on women entrepreneurs in the pre-colonial, colonial, and present day time period. How important is entrepreneurship and business in Yoruba society?
Well, entrepreneurship and business is very, very important in Yoruba society. As I say in the book, entrepreneurship is really built into the cultural context of Yoruba population. So entrepreneurship, even in the pre-colonial period, on through the colonial era and even today, has been part and parcel of the way people operate. There is a positive value associated with being industrious, doing something to enhance the livelihood of your family and also your community as a whole. And so within the Yoruba cultural context, there was the idea that everyone should really be doing some gainful activity, that they should be engaged in productive activity. And entrepreneurship really is about the development of productive assets in the economic marketplace. And so long before Europeans went to Nigeria, long before they penetrated the continent, at least in Yorubaland, people were engaged in entrepreneurship and also trade activities. And so you had male and female involvement. And one of the things that I point out in Yoruba creativity, cultural practices of the modern world, is that you also had women having a dominance in the local markets. And even today, when you go to Yoruba land, you're going to see market women. They are selling their wares. They're hawking these things out on the highways, the byways, on stalls, everywhere in the marketplaces. You're going to see a predominance of females in local markets. You're also going to see males out there involved in selling. The informal economy is very, very large in Nigeria and is growing rapidly because the government hasn't created enough jobs for the citizenry. And so in order to deal with that fact, you have to create job for yourself by having your own business or entrepreneurial pursuits. And so women and men have been involved in that. I want to also point out that women and men were involved in long-distance trade. Although males were the most dominant participants in long-distance trade, some women were also very, very involved. And also with regard to women, women were also involved in trade in pre-colonial, colonial, and even post-colonial. And some of the women that I mentioned, I'll mention a couple of examples. Madame Denebu was a woman in the when you look at the colonial period, she was involved in international trade of munitions, guns, and other kinds of things. And she was doing a lot of things that people would say are not traditional for a woman to have been doing at that time. And so this is something that is of great interest. These women that were very, very engaged, not just in entrepreneurship, but they also had alignments with political leaders. And some of them also acquire chieftaincies because of the things that they were doing to help their country or help their regions, their leaders. And so these are things that are pointed out. I might also mention another great example of a contemporary female entrepreneur who's successful is our relative, Lady Sumbo Shuramakam, who started in a very simple way and now is an international entrepreneur. She started just hawking as a young girl selling food items, and then she began to use that profit to put it back into the company. Eventually, she had stores that she was using to sell through in the stores that she established. And then now she owns her own hotel, built it from ground level zero, beautiful rooms in that hotel in Lagos. And, of course, she travels to Dubai and China and involved in purchasing products, bringing them back to for resale purposes, and also has a multi-story building that she owns in Lagos. And so women have made remarkable strides. Some of them are extraordinarily talented women in the area of entrepreneurship. I wish I could go on and on because there are two chapters that are devoted to entrepreneurship, and I encourage you, the readers, to look at those because there are lots of examples of what's happening in that sector.
Now, you are the president and founder of the International Black Business Museum. I believe the only one in the world. That's astounding, Dr. House. Can you tell us about the mission and goal of the museum?
Absolutely. The International Black Business Museum was created in 2019, in August of 2019. And the mission of the International Black Business Museum is to preserve the history of Black enterprise locally, nationally, and internationally. So our goal is to really look at the history of Black entrepreneurs and inventors and to really let the world know the tremendous genius of this community of people. Many people don't really know about many of the inventions that people of color have created. They don't know about the kinds of businesses they established. They don't know about the ways that they were able to acquire profit in their companies. They don't know very much about the impact of these entrepreneurs historically across time and space. And so our museum is the first and only museum in the world that focuses primary attention on Black entrepreneurs and inventors. And we're very delighted about it. In the COVID period, we have been operating virtually, but our expectation is that we will have a permanent site in the near future. So we're really excited to get the word out. And for those in the audience who want to find out more, they can visit our website at www.theibbm.com. www.theibbm.com.
Great. How does your work as president of the International Black Business Museum, connect with your research on African business owners and African American business owners?
Again, another very good question. There is a tremendous connectivity point between a lot of the things that I do. So how does this research, how does it focus on the museum? How does there a connection? Well, there is a very central connection because a lot of my research has focused on entrepreneurship. And in Yoruba creativity, I'm focusing on Yoruba entrepreneurs. In earlier work, some of my earlier books have focused on confronting the odds, African-American entrepreneurship in Cleveland, Ohio. And when I looked at the Black entrepreneurs in Cleveland, I was looking at what factors promote success and failure and using that to create programs to train people about how to start their own businesses. And so the connection between the research and the museum is simply this, that my research in terms of doing it for 20 years led me to the realization that we needed to have a physical museum to codify this information, to really take all this information that I've been researching and others have been focusing on and really put it into a physical repository so that people can come and see for themselves through the exhibits that we're establishing the tremendous brilliance of entrepreneurs, not just in the United States, but also African entrepreneurs, because the museum is a global museum, the International Black Business Museum. So we're looking at the narrative, the history of Black enterprise globally. So we're connecting what's going on in America with what's going on in Africa and also in Latin America, Central America, the Caribbean. wherever Black people have been, they have been involved in productive entrepreneurial pursuits. And very few people have been able to connect the dots across time and space. And so that's what we're doing. This museum is going to be fantastic when we get our building set up, and people are going to be coming to that museum from all over the world. It will be a beacon of hope, a beacon of light for the art of the possible. Imagine how much more people can do today with technology and the infrastructure. Now people can use social media to connect themselves with entrepreneurs in other parts of the world. And so it's going to be an extraordinary opportunity for us to work with other people in other countries to move the museum down to another level.
Great. I can't wait to see the physical space. Why is the work of the International Black Business Museum so important right now?
Well, the work of the International Black Business Museum is more important now than ever before, because we have forces in society that are trying to push back progress. We also have people who are challenging what students are learning or and are not learning in school. And there are even efforts, conspiracy theories, all kinds of things out there in the world that really seek to really change the reality of what has actually happened in the world and in the United States. And as scholars who have academic freedom, we must constantly make sure that the real stories are told. And this museum is going to codify and solidify the fact that African Americans in this country for hundreds of years have been making tremendous strides in business. They have created companies from scratch, in many cases without capital from the majority-owned banks. I like to use one of my favorite quotes, which is that African Americans have been pulling themselves up by their bootstraps even when they didn't have boots to wear. So they have had to make something out of nothing again and again and again. And entrepreneurship is a positive endeavor. People don't start businesses thinking that they're going to fail. They start businesses believing that they will succeed. And so it is that positive spirit that must be brought to life. And now is the perfect time. As I mentioned before, we have the globalization of interest in diversity. And it's real. We're in a great historical moment now. And I must admit, I can't remember having been in such a moment in during my lifetime where there is a positive concern about making sure we have diverse stories on television, in the media. You have more movies now talking about diversity. You have Netflix, you have Apple TV, you have all of them, Hallmark Station, trying to get Black stories and narratives out there. And so I think we're perfectly poised and in a right place at the right time to captivate interest and to connect ourselves with this desire for people to know more about people of color. People really want to know, what did they do? How did they do it? Why did they do it? And so I'm happy to be the president and founder of the International Black Business Museum. We have a great board of directors, and we have some really phenomenal initiatives that we're going to try to get support for to move them forward.
Now, speaking of entrepreneurs and entrepreneurial endeavors, you served as the founding executive director of the Entrepreneurial Academy of the former Cleveland Empowerment Zone some years ago. Now, I was one of the participants and graduates of this outstanding program. Now, when you look back on your work at the Entrepreneurial Academy, what kinds of things come to mind, and did you achieve your mission when you were there?
Oh, a very, very good question again, Ms. Kennedy, and I'm happy that you mentioned your connection there, because you were one of our most outstanding graduates of the Entrepreneurial Academy of the Greater Cleveland. So we were there from about 2004 through possibly 2007, that time period, and the Entrepreneurial Academy was connected with the Center for the Study and Development of Minority Businesses at Kent State University that I directed at that time. So the Entrepreneurial Academy was an extension of that. We created an office, a center, an entrepreneurial center on St. Clair and 105. So what kinds of connections were there? Did we achieve? What did I think that we really achieved? Well, I thought we achieved quite a lot in working with the City of Cleveland Empowerment Zone. It was an Empowerment Zone initiative. So at that time, we had an opportunity to work with some great community leaders, such as Stephen Sims, who was the Director of Economic Development when Mayor Jane Campbell was the mayor. We also worked with Anthony Houston, who was the director of the Entrepreneurial Academy at that time. We were in the Shore Bank building. And of course, we had quite a lot of people who attended our classes. And that curriculum was a curriculum that I developed out of my own research on the needs of entrepreneurs. How do they succeed? Why do they fail? And really making it hands-on and user-friendly. And so I'm delighted to say that we had a lot of participants. The standards were very high, but we were able to get people who moved through the system and graduated. And a number of businesses were started on our watch. And, of course, I forgot to mention John Bustamante, who was bigger than life, this very successful entrepreneur who was our executive business coach. And Michael Valentine was our business plan developer, helped our students to develop business plans. And we had a team of instructors as well. It was a fantastic experience for me. And again, this is a prime example of how academics can use their knowledge to go out and help the world to solve real world problems, to connect the university with the community around it. Universities are not ivory towers in isolation from the world. And so I think it was a great collaboration because we worked with the Glenville, we worked with Huff, we work with Fairfax and also Midtown Corridor, the Community Development Corporations. And so I think that we exceeded our goals. We came out with very simple expectations, and all of those expectations were exceeded by the reality of what happened. The students were amazing, brilliant minds in the urban core, and creativity and imagination was really, really very high. And the attendance of the students was phenomenal. They were fired up. They were excited. We had new businesses being created, and we also had some businesses that were expanded on our watch. And so I would say that it was one of the most significant time periods of my life where we had the idea being able to come into reality. And I would love to jumpstart that again and to reestablish the E-Academy in the future.
Your seventh book, Yoruba Creativity, Cultural Practices of the Modern World. Why should people purchase a copy of your book?
Well, Yoruba Creativity, Cultural Practices of the Modern World would be a great addition to anyone's collection in their homes or in their libraries for a variety of reasons. First of all, it puts a very positive projection of African society, which is really what we need in this at this particular time period. We see a lot of negative images about people of color constantly on the media, in books, etc. And Yoruba Creativity talks about the wonderful cultural values of the Yoruba population in Nigeria and also the Yoruba population in the United States and other regions. And these values cover the value of women and men, the value of children, the cultural importance of educating children and teaching them rules and regulations to govern themselves in terms of interacting with the family and the society. And so you have all these wonderful cultural values in terms of the family. You also have positive values in terms of the notion of work and entrepreneurship and how to make a difference in the society by being gainfully engaged in some productive endeavor. You also have very positive information about these key institutions of kingship and queenship and chieftaincies and the information about African kings and queens and these wonderful kingdoms, Yoruba kingdoms, that date back hundreds of years, if not longer. And you also have a lot of efforts being made in Yoruba land to improve the condition of the population. There are earnest people who are engaged every day, simple men and women who believe that they can make a difference in the society. And so I think all of these reasons really point to the significance of the book in terms of having a role in your library or somewhere on your library shelf. And also for using in classes, professors can use it in their classes when they're teaching about Africa. They can use it in courses on African politics, African history, women's studies. They can also use it for multicultural purposes and political science courses. You can use it in a variety of ways. And so we hope that it will have a long impact.
Oh, I'm sure that it will. I know that you are working on some additional books right now. Can you give us a brief word about your upcoming books?
Absolutely. My eighth book is in process. I've been working on that for Indiana University Press. It's under contract with IU Press, and that book is titled African American Entrepreneurship, Philanthropic Giving, Self-Help, and the Struggle for Economic Empowerment. And this is the first comprehensive book ever written about Black business philanthropy, the first comprehensive book on that topic, meaning that very few scholars have really looked at how African Americans are using their resources in a world of charitable giving. More particularly, they haven't really examined how African American entrepreneurs have interacted with other parts of the population and used some of their resources to enhance the condition of other members of their community and the broader society. And so it's a very exciting work. I've been doing research for several years, and I received a grant from the Indiana University Bloomington some years ago. And also I've done research at the Schomburg Center for the Study of Black Culture in Harlem, New York. I've done research at the Western Reserve Historical Society in Cleveland, the Indiana Historical Society as well, and also the Senator Henry Heintz History Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So I've done a lot of library research as well, and lots of books, articles, and also some interviews that I've been conducting with entrepreneurs about the philosophies that they have that undergird why they give, how they give, and a lot of other things about how they build social capital networks in the community, et cetera. So this is a very exciting book, working on it almost daily to make sure that I complete it. I'm also working on a book with my daughter, who is a very, very intelligent young lady, and we are working on a book on reimagining the African diaspora, where we're going to interrogate the movie Black Panther 1 and Black Panther 2 and really look at some of the ideas that were put forward in the movie and look at how we can use that as a springboard to really talk about economic and political development in the United States and in African societies as a whole. How do we reimagine the diaspora? How can we reconnect the diaspora with Africa and Africa with the diaspora? And we want to especially get young people's voices in some chapters. We're going to do it collaboratively and invite people to also write some chapters, particularly millennials and Generation Z, as well as older scholars. And we think that's going to be a very exciting book to engage conversations on these topics.
Now, I know that you've had 7 books. I think this is the 8th one that's coming out shortly. Where can people purchase copies of the book?
Okay, so Yoruba Creativity, Cultural Practices of the Modern World, can be purchased by going to the website of Carolina Academic Press, Carolina Academic Press. And then I'm also selling copies of the book as well. As you know, I do. I'm doing book lectures. Mm-hmm. And going to various sites where I'm doing book signings, so people can also purchase them from me, or they can go directly to Carolina Academic Press to get copies of the book. They can also access my website at www.drbhouse.com, and there will be also information on how they can get the book if they want directly to have the book. So those will be the options there, either through Carolina Academic Press or, you know, via my own collection of these books as I go out and about to do these signings.
Wonderful. Now, we have a few minutes left. So are there any last minute summations about that you would like to discuss, to talk about, whatever. You have a multitude of things going on, a plethora of activities and things at the museum, the new book. Give us a summarization of what Dr. House foresees in the future for yourself and for the International Black Business Museum, for the new book and the next book. Just what would you like to say, Dr. House?
Well, I would like to just emphasize to our communities that are watching this discussion today that economic development issues loom large in the Black community. So beyond the work on entrepreneurship, there's the bigger condition of the Black community in the United States and abroad. And I do want to mention that we are trying to do some things where we can really call together some national forums and maybe even having some global conferences that really look at the plight of our communities and ways that we can really do more economically to pool our resources to really enhance the condition of our population. We generate a lot of revenue in terms of earnings in this country, but a lot of those earnings are not directed to our own community. They're moving out of our neighborhoods. And so we need to really think about ways that we can support businesses in the African-American community and the way that we can facilitate the development of capital and how we can really make sure that we are providing support for upcoming entrepreneurs. And so these are some of the concerns that we have. And so we're going to be dealing with some of these in global economic summits that we're going to be sponsoring in the future. And we invite people to visit our website, www.theibbm.com, to talk about other kinds of things that we're going to be doing. And we do have the Entrepreneurial Masterclass series on Zoom that we started earlier this year that were very successful. And we're going to be resuming those in the near future. And those masterclasses are taught by, you know, entrepreneurs who come in as our guest speakers. We could be physicians in some cases. They came in to talk about COVID impact on our population. We also have practitioners, people who are doing important work out in the population, community leaders. So we have an amalgamation of speakers coming in. And I am the host and moderator of the Entrepreneurial Masterclass series on Zoom. And so far, we have been able to offer them free to the public. And so we encourage you, again, to go to our website and find out about when they're going to be upcoming. And we got some exciting topics coming down in the future, coming around the bend.
Now, could you give us that website again, Dr. House, to access all the information and the master classes? By the way, I was in the master class. You had Dr. Juliet Walker. I think she's on your board, isn't she?
Yes, yes. Dr. Juliet E.K. Walker is on our board of directors, and she is considered to be the foremost scholar on Black business history in America and possibly the world. She has written so many articles, and her book, The History of Black Business in America, Capitalism, Race, Entrepreneurship, won numerous awards. It's just outstanding in its breadth and scope. Dr. Walker is a member of our board of directors and extraordinary. You're absolutely correct. She was our kickoff speaker, our first one on the Entrepreneurial Masterclasses. We will bring her back again in the future. And our web address is www.theibbm.com. www.theibbm.com.
Well, Dr. House, at the top of the hour, we really didn't talk about a lot of your accolades and the things that you're doing, so we have a couple minutes. Dr. Bessie House-Sormeekam is the president and CEO of BHS Creations, LLC, a company that provides products that reflect the beauty and diversity of the human experience. She is the president and founder, as we said, of the International Black Business Museum, the first museum in the world dedicated to chronicling the history of Black enterprise. You have received numerous awards for academic achievement, research, service, community and civic engagement, and the organization of international conferences. You have been featured on the covers of Northern Ohio Live magazine, the city newspaper, and other venues. Your research has also been featured in the Cleveland Plain Dealer, the Akron Beacon Journal, and Crane's Business Newspaper. You have appeared on the Kaleidoscope television show, on Work and Money TV show, on ABC and NBC News affiliates, and on National Public Radio, among other radio programs. You are also the host of your own television show in Cleveland, Let's Talk Business, and the host of your own internet radio show, The Dr. Bessie House Show. And again, you hold three chieftaincy titles, and I'm not even going to try to say the name. Could you please tell us again your titles, Dr. House, you and your husband?
Okay, absolutely. My three titles are Erelu Bada Asiwaju of Ekbalan, Eregu Mayagun of Casey, and the Ayalaje of Bakatari Christians. My husband's titles are Bada Asiwaju of Ekbalan and the Mayagun of Casey, and also he has one from the Bakatari Christians as well. Balagun of Bakatari Christians, the Balagun of Bakatari Christians. So he has three chieftaincies and I have three. So together we have six chieftaincies, and we are deeply humbled by that, and we will always remember those occasions.
Now, this event has been sponsored by the International Black Business Museum, which is dedicated to preserving the history of black enterprise locally, nationally, and internationally. Thank you, Dr. Bessie House-Sormeekin.
Thank you. It was a pleasure, Ms. Kennedy.
Always.